I want to begin our discussion this morning with a story of a time when Israel was faced with what rightly seemed like an impassable obstacle, the Red Sea. So if you will, open your Bibles to Exodus chapter 13 and 14. That's where we'll begin our discussion this morning. We're not going to read all of the story. I'm going to kind of point to some key verses and we'll sum things up as we go along. You'll remember that Israel, the nation, has been enslaved in Egypt for many centuries. And they've grown from a small family to a large nation. And God had called them then out of Egypt to make them his own special people. He's going to bring them ultimately to Sinai and give them the law and make a covenant with them to make them into the nation of Israel before leading them into the promised land. And of course, all that was in fulfillment of prior promises God had given to Abraham that through his descendants, all the nations of the earth would be blessed, because ultimately the Messiah, Jesus Christ, is going to come through the lineage of Abraham and then through Jacob or Israel and this nation that God is establishing here. What's interesting is when they leave Egypt, we read in Exodus chapter 13 and in verse 18, the latter half of that, that the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. And so they're leaving Egypt in a very grand fashion. In fact, this is after witnessing the 10 plagues that God has executed against Egypt, thereby demonstrating his mighty hand and bringing judgment not just against the Egyptians, but also all of the gods of Egypt. And what's interesting is that when the Israelites left, they didn't leave as paupers. They didn't look like slaves when they left. In fact, God had given them instruction that when they left the land, they were to ask their neighbors, the Egyptians, for special favors, for gifts. Exodus chapter 12, verses 35 and 36, where it says, "Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they left them," or they let them have their request. And notice it says, "Thus they plundered the Egyptians." Right? So the night before, God has gone through the nation of Egypt and slaughtered the firstborn in every household except for those of the Israelites who put the blood of the Passover lamb on their doorposts and lintel. God passed over their houses in that judgment. And the people wake up in the middle of the night and every household has somebody dead in it. Okay? And there's this great cry that goes throughout all the land of Egypt. And the next morning, Pharaoh, unlike he had been doing previously where he was saying, "No, I'm not going to let you go," is basically begging Moses to take the Israelites out of Egypt. And all of the people want them to get out, because if they stay here any longer, they're afraid that God is going to annihilate the entire nation of Egypt. And so what's interesting is, without lifting a finger of their own, without taking up arms against their enemy, in a real practical way, Israel had a great slaughter of the enemy. And they have plundered the enemy, much like would happen when you'd go and conquer a city. You kill a bunch of people and they finally give up, and you go in and you take all their stuff. Well, the Israelites have done that essentially to the nation of Egypt without them ever having to raise or lift a finger. And so they set out on this journey. We read in verse 37 of Exodus chapter 12, "The sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. And a mixed multitude also went up with them, along with the flocks and the herds, a very large number of livestock." And so we're given this number of 600,000 men on foot, and that's probably a reference to just the fighting age men, 20 and over, that were capable of going into battle. And so the estimates suggest that when you count all of their wives and all of the children and all of the people that were under the age of 20 and things like that, and this mixed multitude that's going up with them, which would have been people who were not Israelites or direct descendants of Abraham and Jacob, estimates put their number in somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5 million people, along with their flocks and their herds and their animals. So you've got this great mass of people and animals now caravanning out of Egypt in martial array, decked with gold and silver and all this great stuff, the wealth of Egypt. They've taken as plunder and they're leaving. They look like a victorious army setting out. And what's interesting is that they are guided by God and directed by His actual presence, like He physically manifests Himself. We read in chapter 13 and in verse 21 that the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on their way, in a pillar of fire by night to give them light that they might travel by day and by night. And He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. There is this almost maybe like a whirlwind or something, a cloud and fire. I don't know exactly what it looked like, but there was something tangible there that the people could see that was God's presence leading them on this journey, leading them in victory. And things are going real well for the Israelites at this point in time. But then courses are changed, and they're redirected by God on a rather unusual route. If you jump back in the text there to Exodus chapter 13 and verse 17, it says, "Now when Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was near." Now, if you know anything about the geography of the area, and maybe I should have put a map up, it would have helped us, but you've got the Mediterranean Sea, okay? You have Egypt down here in the south. And if you just travel up the coastline, you go right into the southern portion of the Promised Land. That was where the Philistines dwelt. That was the most direct route. That would be the most logical way to go from Egypt to the Promised Land. But God doesn't lead them that way, even though it was near. For God said the people might change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea, verse 18, and the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. And when you jump down to verse 20, it says, they set out from Succoth and camped in Etham on the edge of the wilderness. They kind of start to wander aimlessly around a little bit. Where are they going? Well, in chapter 14, the Lord spoke to Moses, verse 1, saying, tell the sons of Israel to turn back and camp before Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. You shall camp in front of Baal Zephon, opposite it by the sea. So God's leading them out. I just want you to have this picture. God's leading them out. Things seem to be going really well. And then as they set out on their course, they are told, don't take the most logical route to your destination. I want you to wander over here. And they do that, and they're following God's direction. And God is with them in the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. And then God says, I want you to turn around and go back the way that you came. And I want you to go down here, and I want you to camp between this little town and the sea. Okay. Well, that doesn't seem to be the direction we ought to be going, God. That seems to be the opposite of the direction we ought to be going. You're leading us into a trap, it would seem. And that's ultimately what happens. We read in verse 3, God said, Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they're wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. And thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he'll chase after them, and I'll be honored through Pharaoh and through all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. And they did so. And so they're following God's direction, as confusing as it may be, as irrational as it may seem to them, as unlikely of a scenario that would seem to lead to good things. But God has a plan. So they find themselves now backed up between the Red Sea and this little town. And when Pharaoh looks out and sees them wandering aimlessly around, he thinks these stupid idiots, that God gave them this victory and now they can't even figure out where to go. We need to go capture them again. We were kind of stupid in letting our workforce go. And so he gathers up his chariots and his armies and he gives chase. And now not only are the Israelites walking towards an impassable obstacle, the Red Sea, but now coming up from behind them is the armies of Egypt. And pretty quickly they find themselves pinned in between a rock and a hard place. Really, it's between the sea and the armies of Egypt. They've got nowhere to go, nowhere to turn. They can't go forward because the sea is there. They can't go backwards because their enemy is chasing them. So what are they supposed to do? What's interesting to me is that we're given some insight into how the people felt at this time. If you look in verse 10, as Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. They're scared. And maybe rightly so. You've got your enemies who you just plundered now giving chase, and you're stuck in a position where you can't get out of. And so they cried out to the Lord. And no doubt they're probably confused, and that may be behind their statement in verse 11 when they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? Well, why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt?" Like, you know, what's the deal, Moses? You said you were going to bring us out of Egypt, but you just keep wandering us around the outskirts of it. Now you got us trapped. We're going to die. They're confused. Why would we be going in this direction? And they felt, and certainly were, trapped and doomed. Verse 12. "Is this not the word which we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians,' for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness?" They're saying, you know, it would have been better if we just stayed their slaves rather than come out here and then come and slaughter us. Because that's certainly what they saw was going to happen. What's interesting to me is that they felt that way in spite of all the great things that they had just witnessed God doing for and through them, and bringing them out of Egypt so powerfully. Let's pause there in our story and let me ask you this question. Have you ever felt that way about circumstances in your life? Scared? Confused? Hopeless? You know, maybe it was due to a work-related issue. You had to change careers, change an employer. Maybe it was because of downsizing and layoffs. You know, sometimes when the economy's not doing so good, low man on the totem pole gets the axe. Now you got to go find a new place to work. That can be scary. How am I going to provide for my family? How are we going to make ends meet? Where am I going to find gainful employment? Is this going to require us to have to move from where we're living to a new town, to a new state? All of those kind of things can be intimidating. Maybe it's not that you've lost your job. Maybe it's that you've got a new boss. And the new boss has a different managing style than the old boss. And it's kind of like, I don't know, I used to work well with the old boss, but now things are different. I'm having a hard time figuring out what I'm supposed to do. What are the expectations? There's no communication. I feel lost. I feel like this is not working. Maybe you felt that way because of some health issues, either your own or those of someone that you loved. Steph commented to me the other day, "Why are so many people getting cancer?" I don't know, but I feel like every time I turn around, I'm hearing about somebody else has cancer. I'm like, what do you do about that? What can you do about that? It's scary. Especially when we see so many young people getting cancer. It makes you worry. Maybe you might get cancer. Maybe your kids might get cancer. What are you going to do then? All of this unknown. Maybe it's because you've experienced a death of someone close to you recently. Maybe it was through a tragedy, like a car accident or something like that. You just, what do? You feel lost. Maybe it's due to relational conflicts. Maybe in your marriage, things are not going so well. Maybe you and your husband or you and your wife are having a hard time getting along with one another. Maybe it has to do with the greater family dynamics. You know, you're having such a hard time with your in-laws or something like that. You just can't seem to get along. You can't be on the same page. Maybe it's with your friends or your coworkers. There's conflict. You feel like you don't know what to do. Like it's hopeless. So the question I want us to consider this morning is, how do we as children of God respond when we are inevitably confronted by those kinds of situations in our lives? I want to look just a little bit at what the psalmist has to say and how he expressed it when he was going through various trials. Start with me in Psalm 35. And as we read these psalms together, I want you to think to yourself, can I relate to what the psalmist is saying here? Here in Psalm 35, it's a psalm of David, by the way, and he is pouring out his heart to God about the unfair, unjust treatment that he is receiving, probably at the hands of Saul. He begins in verse 1, he says, "Contend, O Lord, with those who contend with me. Fight against those who fight against me. Take hold of the buckler and shield and rise up for my help. Draw also the spear and the battle axe to meet those who pursue me. Say to my soul, I am your salvation. And let those be ashamed and dishonored who seek my life. Let those be turned back and humiliated who devise evil against me. Let them be like chaff before the wind with the angel of the Lord driving them on. Let their way be dark and slippery with the angel of the Lord pursuing them. For without cause they hid their net for me, and without cause they dug a pit for my soul. Let destruction come upon him unawares, and let the net which he hid catch himself. Into that very destruction let him fall. My soul shall rejoice in the Lord. I shall exult in his salvation. All my bones will say, Lord, who is like you, who delivers the afflicted from him who is too strong for him, and the afflicted and the needy from him who robs him?" Now, David in his life was oftentimes literally being chased by sword and spear. Like, his life was literally being threatened by death from his enemies. And he spent much of his early years on the run from Saul, who wanted nothing more but to get rid of David, who he saw as a threat to the throne. And so when David says, you know, "Take notice, Lord, of those who are chasing after me to take my life," that's probably not hyperbole. Like, he probably literally was experiencing those things. But metaphorically, can you relate to some of that? You ever feel like people are just out to get you? Like, you're constantly looking over your shoulder, on the run, trying to just survive. Well, what did David do here? He turns to God. He asks God for salvation and deliverance. What's more is something that David does not do. He doesn't sink to their level. He doesn't sink to the level of his enemies. Notice as we continue on to verse 11, he says, "Malicious witnesses rise up. They ask me of things I do not know. They repay me evil for good to the bereavement of my soul." They're doing all this really bad stuff to me. They're trying to capture me. They're trying to get me in a pickle. But notice his attitude towards them when bad things befall them. Verse 13, "But as for me, when they are sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled my soul with fasting, and my prayer kept returning to my bosom. I went about as though it were my friend or a brother. I bowed down mourning as one who sorrows for a mother." He says, when they were going through hard times, I was praying for them. I was thinking about them the way I would think about a friend or my mother. Someone that I care about. But that's not what they were doing. Verse 15, "But at my stumbling they rejoiced and gathered themselves together. The smiters whom I did not know gathered together against me. They slandered me without ceasing. Like godless jesters at a feast, they gnashed at me with their teeth." Returning evil for good is what they were doing. David's trying to return good for evil. And so again, he calls on the Lord. "Lord, how long will you look on? Rescue my soul from their ravages, my only life from the lions. I will give you thanks in the great congregation. I will praise you among the mighty throne. Do not let those who are wrongfully my enemies rejoice over me, nor let those who hate me without cause wink maliciously. For they do not speak peace, but they devise deceitful words against those who are quiet in the land. They open their mouth wide against me, and they said, 'Aha, aha, our eyes have seen it.' You have seen it, O Lord. Do not keep silent. O Lord, do not be far from me. Stir up yourself and awake to my right and to my cause, my God and my Lord. Judge me, O Lord, my God, according to your righteousness, and do not let them rejoice over me. Do not let them say in their heart, 'Aha, our desire.' Do not let them say, 'We have swallowed him up.' Let those be ashamed and humiliated altogether who rejoice at my distress. And let those be clothed with shame and dishonor who magnify themselves over me. Let them shout for joy and rejoice who favor my vindication. And let them say continually, the Lord be magnified who delights in the prosperity of his servants. And my tongue shall declare your righteousness and your praise all day long. David didn't take matters into his own hands and try to get even with his enemies, who were, by the way, wrongfully his enemies, unfairly, unjustly mistreating and persecuting him. Instead, he gave it to the Lord. He said, you handle it, God. I'm going to trust you that in the end, you're going to make sure the right thing happens. And so we see that recurring theme here of putting our trust in God. Which, by the way, is exactly how Jesus endured the persecution and the mistreatment that he faced on the cross. In 1 Peter chapter 2, 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 21, Peter says, for you've been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but what? Kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. When Jesus was enduring unfairly, unjustly, all that mistreatment on the cross, instead of railing back against his enemies, he humbly submitted himself to his Father, putting his trust in him. And Peter says he did that as an example for us to follow. And what's interesting contextually, if you jump back to verse 18 through 20, even servants, or for our perspective today, employees who work for bosses who are not just those who are good and gentle, but also those who are unreasonable, we're supposed to submit to them. You think, what? I'm supposed to subject myself to mistreatment from a terrible boss? Well, he says, this finds favor, verse 19. If for the sake of conscience towards God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. You know, if you're unjustly being mistreated and you bear up under that patiently, and by the way that we could bear up under that under an employer today is slightly different than what they would have had to do as a slave back in the ancient world. We may have some other options and still be able to bear up graciously underneath that mistreatment. But he says, you know, what credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure with it? You know, if you do the wrong thing and you get punished for that and then you just take that patiently, that doesn't find any credit with God. That's what you deserve. But if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. You know, when we respond in a godly way to the mistreatment that we might endure from other people, and instead of retaliating, instead of sinking to their level, putting our trust in God and saying, God, help me get through this, and trying to shine our light through the process, God smiles upon you when you do that. That's what it means when it says that that finds favor with God. God looks down upon you and it makes him smile when he sees you doing the right thing, even when that's hard to do. And I would suggest to you the only way that we're going to be successful in that is if we actually put our trust in God. But that leads to another interesting point and observation, because what do we do when I'm being mistreated and it's kind of my fault? Or at least my imperfections compound or complicate my situation. We'll go back to Psalm 38. Notice how the psalmist says it here again, the Psalm of David. Beginning in verse 1, he says, O Lord, rebuke me not in your wrath, and chasten me not in your burning anger. For your arrows have sunk deep into me, and your hand is pressed down on me. There is no soundness in my flesh because of your indignation. There is no health in my bones because of my sin. For my iniquities are gone over my head, as a heavy burden, they weigh too much for me. My wounds grow foul and fester because of my folly. I'm bent over and greatly bowed down. I go mourning all day long, for my loins are filled with burning, and there is no soundness in my flesh. I am am benumbed and sadly crushed. I groan because of the agitation of my heart. Recognize at the beginning of this psalm, David starts out by acknowledging the fact that he is not perfect. You know, the previous song, he says, I didn't do anything to deserve this. And yet people are mistreating me. Here he's saying, God, I know that I've sinned. And what's more, I recognize that my sin is having an effect on my life as a whole. Here he likens it to somebody who's wounded in battle, and then that wound becomes infected and gangrenous and foul and festering, and it won't heal. Right? And notice he goes on to describe the effect that has on those who are around him, even those who would typically love him and want to be his companion. Lord, verse 9, all my desire is before you, and my sighing is not hidden from you. My heart throbs, my strength fails, and the light of my eyes, even that has gone from me. My loved ones and my friends, they stand aloof from my plague, and my kinsman stands afar off. And those who seek my life lay snares for me, and those who seek to injure me have threatened destruction, and they devise treachery all day long. He says, I recognize that my sin has caused such problems in my life that those who I want to be on my side are saying, ooh, man, I can't be with you when you're involved in all that. And they got to stand aloof. And yet it's at the same time giving ammunition to his enemies. They're over there going, oh yeah, we got some dirt on you now. And notice this, verse 13. But I, like a deaf man, do not hear. And I'm like a mute man who does not open his mouth. Yes, I'm like a man who does not hear and in whose mouth are no arguments. When the enemy plots, when the enemy is going to use his wickedness and his sin as a means to cudgel him into whatever they want, he says, I have no defense. I have no legs to stand on because I know that I've sinned. I don't have an argument to justify myself. I'm wrong. And so what do we do then? When we recognize that our sin is having a real negative effect on the way that we're treated. Well, again, trust in the Lord. Verse 15, for I hope in you, O Lord. You will answer me, O Lord my God. For I said, may they not rejoice over me, who when my foot slips would magnify themselves against me. For I am ready to fall, and my sorrow is continually before me. For I confess my iniquity. I'm full of anxiety because of my sin. But my enemies are vigorous and strong, and many are those who hate me wrongfully, and those who repay evil for good. They oppose me because I follow what's good. Do not forsake me, O Lord. O my God, do not be far from me. Make haste to help me, O Lord, my salvation. And the psalmist recognizes that if he's going to have any hope of overcoming any of this, even the guilt of his sin, that lies only in God. Sometimes it seems like God isn't even watching, though. Wicked people are doing what they want, mistreating others, taking advantage, and they're getting away scot-free. The psalmist addressed this idea in Psalm 10. He begins by saying, why do you stand afar off, O Lord? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In pride, the wicked hotly pursue the afflicted. Let them be caught in the plots which they've devised. For the wicked boasts in his heart's desire, and the greedy man curses and spurns the Lord. The wicked, in the haughtiness of his countenance, does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. His ways prosper at all times. Your judgments are on high, out of his sight. As for all his adversaries, he snorts at them. He says of himself, I shall not be moved. Throughout all the generations, I will not be in adversity. His mouth is full of curses and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue is mischief and wickedness. He sits in the lurking places of the village, in the hiding places. He kills the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the unfortunate. He lurks in a hiding place as a lion in his lair. He lurks to catch the afflicted. He catches the afflicted when he draws him into his nets. He crouches, he bows down, and the unfortunate fall by his mighty ones. And he says to himself, God has forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. Can you relate to that? You look around at people and you think, man, how in the world are they so successful in life? I mean, they are wicked. They are corrupt. They're deceitful. They're taking advantage of people. They're abusing the less fortunate. and yet they seem to be succeeding. Is God not paying attention? We might ask ourselves. Well, ironically, that's the very mindset that these people have. They say, I can do whatever I want. God doesn't see it. God's not going to do anything about it. It's in times like this that we cannot forget that ultimately God is still in control. Verse 12, arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Do not forget the afflicted. Why has the wicked spurned God? He has said to himself, you'll not require it. You've seen it, for you have beheld mischief and vexation to take it into your hand. The unfortunate commits himself to you. You have been the helper of the orphan. Break the arm of the wicked and the evildoer. Seek out his wickedness until you find none. The Lord is king forever and ever. Nations have perished from his land. O Lord, you have heard the desire of the humble. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to vindicate the orphan and the oppressed, so that man who is of the earth will no longer cause terror. Even in the times, guys, where it seems like God isn't paying attention, he's still in control. And we still need to trust in him. So you see the common theme? When we're faced with these trials, the response is to put our trust in God, to look to him for answers, for direction, for purpose. And here's something I want to impress upon our minds. God never promised that this life would be easy. In fact, he never promised that life would be without difficulties or obstacles or trials. He never promised that life would be fair. I think about the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 through 10. He had that thorn in the flesh that he prayed to God three times that it would be taken away, and God said, no, my grace is sufficient. And Paul's conclusion about that is that he'll rejoice in his affliction because when he is weak, then he is strong. That's when he is physically weak, he realizes, I can't do this on my own, and so he relies upon the strength of God. And it's interesting to me is that Paul begins that section by saying that there was a thorn in the flesh that was given to me to keep me humble, to keep me from exalting myself. And sometimes I wonder if God doesn't allow us to go through these trials, through these hardships, because he's trying to keep us humble. To keep us looking to him for answers. That if everything was always going smoothly and exactly the way we think that it ought to go and the way we want it to go all of the time, we would forget about God. We would think we had lifted ourselves up by our own bootstraps and that we are the cause and we are the reason why we're succeeding. And maybe we're going through a trial right now because God is trying to remind us. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Don't be too arrogant. Don't be too prideful and think that you're more than what you actually are. Don't forget to look to me for the answers and the direction and the path that you should go. And I would suggest to you that when I think about this, it's illustrated in Paul, but James will say as much in James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. Count it all joy when you encounter various trials. Attitude, the way that we perceive our trials, our hardships, our difficulties in life, is going to make all the difference. If we approach it with a woe is me, I'm a victim, oh this is terrible, and let's just cry about it, we're probably not going to gain very much from that trial that God has sent our way. But if we'll do like Peter said, and even when we're wrongfully being mistreated, bear up under that patiently and respond in a godly way, we'll build endurance. And James says endurance will have its perfect result. We'll be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. I think another aspect of the attitude, the mindset that we need to have, though, is that we've got to look beyond this life. Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, and in verse 16, talking about some of the terrible things that he's endured in life, and he says, but we do not lose heart, though our outer man is decaying, yet the inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things that are not seen are eternal. You know, sometimes we get so wrapped up in the temporal, in our job, in our families, in our community, in our pursuits in this life, that when those things start to crumble and fall apart, we think everything is lost. But we've got to remember that this life is about much more than just this life. We need to be looking beyond to the eternal, keeping that heavenly mindset. And that certainly is the example that Abraham set in his life. You know, God said, go out from the land that you live in, from your family, from your home country. Go to a land that I'm going to show you. And Abraham went, not knowing where he was going. Never been to Canaan before. When he gets there, God says, I'm going to give this land to your descendants after you for an eternal possession. And Abraham lived the rest of his life. And the only thing he ever owned in Canaan's land was the cave in Machpelah where he buried his wife. The Hebrew writer tells us that Abraham died in faith, not yet receiving the promise. But that didn't matter to Abraham because he was looking for something better. He was looking for an eternal home, not a temporal home. And I like the observation that the Hebrew writer makes there in chapter 11. And in verse, I don't want to misquote it, and in verse 15. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You know, if they had thought about back in Ur of the Chaldees and thought of how good it was back there and longed to go back, they had every opportunity to go back. But they didn't because they were looking forward to their eternal home. And sometimes I wonder about myself, and maybe you can relate to this. I get so wrapped up in the here and now, the temporal, the land from which I'm supposed to have departed. And yet I get so wrapped up in things here that I keep getting drawn back to that temporal mindset rather than looking forward to the future glory of heaven. God may not remove the obstacles from our lives, but he will provide a path through them. He did that at the Red Sea, didn't he? Go back there to Exodus chapter 14. The people are freaking out. The people are scared to death. They're confused. They think all hope is lost. And they cry out. And Moses says to the people in verse 13, "Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent." Moses says, "Don't worry about it, guys. God's got this. He's got a plan. You're not going to have to fight. He's going to take care of the enemy." What I find really interesting, though, about this is that right after Moses says, the Lord's going to fight for you while you keep silent, implying you have nothing that there's nothing you're going to have to do, God's going to take care of it. The Lord says to Moses in verse 15, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward." Sometimes we want to just sit down, hide under a rock, and let God do all the work for us. And God says, "Why are you asking me for help when you need to get up and keep moving forward?" Well, they think there's an impassable obstacle in our way, the Red Sea. God says to Moses, "As for you, lift up your staff and stretch your hand over the sea and divide it, and the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. And as for me, behold, I'll harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they'll go in after them, and I'll be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, through the chariots and his horsemen. And then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen. So the angel of God, who had been going before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel. And there was a cloud along with the darkness, yet it gave light at night. Thus the one did not come near to the other all night. And so Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land. So the waters were divided. Put yourself in that position real quick. God, who's been leading you in this pillar of fire and cloud, goes from the front of your camp now to the back to take his position between you and the threat of the armies of Egypt. And Moses stretches out his hand, and a great wind begins to blow, and that sea begins to divide. And you've got a wall of water on one side and a wall of water on the other side, and Moses is saying, "There you go, guys! Cross!" I don't know about you, but I'd still be terrified. I want you to understand, it took a great amount of faith for the Israelites to traverse the dry land from the parted Red Sea. That's something I don't think we oftentimes give them enough credit for, but what's interesting to me is that the Hebrew writer does, back there in Hebrews chapter 11, when he's listing all of these great heroes of faith. He mentions in verse 29, by faith, they, the Israelites, passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land. I guess what I'm trying to illustrate is this. When it comes to trials, hardships, maybe what may seem like an impassable obstacle in our path of life, we need to view it the same way that the Israelites ultimately viewed it here at the crossing of the Red Sea. Putting our trust in God that He will provide a way through the obstacle. Doesn't mean He'll eliminate the obstacle or take it out of the way, but He'll provide us a path through the hardship, through the trial, through the difficult circumstances. But we're going to have enough faith to do our part and keep moving forward. So that's my question for each of us today. I don't know exactly what hardship or trial or difficulty you are presently facing in your life, but I have a sense that all of us are facing something. Will we learn the lesson from God's Word? That these things are given to us to direct our attention to Him, to help us to have a heavenly, eternal focus, putting our trust in God to do it His way, and that if we do, He will lead us through the trial. But I would suggest to you that you'll only be successful if you have enough faith to follow the path that God has laid out for you.